This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Activist Charlene Carruthers says various social movements are coming together in America.
It's about being really clear that actually black people are queer, black people can be feminist, black people can be all of the things.
Carruthers talks with GLT's Mary Collin ahead of a Martin Luther King speech at Illinois Wesleyan University. Plus, an ISU professor of ethnomusicology takes a spiritual journey to African slave dungeons in Ghana and shares it as part of a TEDx Normal address. Correspondent Colleen Reynolds reports on poverty in the Twin Cities. And arts correspondent Laura Kennedy presents us with a look into the lives of Native Americans in a new exhibit. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The McLean County poverty rate of 13.6% seems a bit low to people who look at such things in the community. The loss of manufacturing jobs, lack of affordable housing, cuts to social service agency funding, and high rates of children that qualify for free and reduced lunches back up that gut feeling expressed by people at a recent League of Women Voters panel discussion on poverty. GLT correspondent Colleen Reynolds reports.
The average person making minimum wage in McLean County would have to work 76 hours a week to be able to afford a two-bedroom apartment here, according to a Heartland Alliance 2018 poverty report. 26% of all McLean County households are considered rent burdened. That's slightly higher than the statewide average. But housing costs are only part of the problem. There are many factors driving residents into poverty. For Starla Hayes, it began when her husband divorced her after 22 years of marriage.
I had three kids. I couldn't deal with getting divorced, so I bailed. I went to drugs and alcohol, and then I came back. I've been back 8 years now? In 4 years in Mayor's Manor. So my kids are let me back in their lives, and but it was a struggle. I mean, when you go down that, the drugs and the alcohol, that's what hurts you. It took my kids a long time to forgive me, and they do now. And I'm grateful for that. And I'm so grateful for Mayor's Manor and Tasha, Senna, Tony. You guys have been amazing. If it wasn't for you, I don't know where I'd be.
Located at the southwest edge of downtown Bloomington, Mayor's Manor has 26 efficiency apartments that provide supportive living for previously homeless single adults. It has been almost at capacity since it opened 8 years ago. Director Tasha Davis of Mid-Central Community Action grew up in Chicago public housing and lived at Sunnyside in Bloomington.
I know what it feels like to be impoverished. Both of my parents were. My mom worked two jobs, and my dad was in the household, but we were still in poverty. And sometimes we can see that right now in the faces of the children that live in McLean County, because we have the working poor. We have individuals that are working two jobs, trying to make ends meet, and they're not making it.
Gina Campbell falls into that category. She graduated from Illinois State University with a bachelor's degree, but started her first job at $10 an hour and had inadequate health insurance. As a type 1 diabetic, Campbell often had to choose between medications costing close to $1,200 a month and buying groceries.
So there just wasn't a sufficient amount of food or drink for me to intake to increase my blood sugar, which is a completely panic-inducing situation. There's a lot of fear. It's a huge fear component that goes into poverty. Your resources aren't reliable. Your support system isn't reliable. You're basically out there stranded on an island just trying to get by with very little. So I had to consume like year-old snow cone syrup. Like that's where I was at personally. At that point, I was like, I need to I can't live like this. I can't live like this. I'm working hard, but this, I can't do this. So I sought out another job, and I sought out a job specifically that would allow me to access government benefits, because I couldn't, if I made a couple dollars more, wasn't going to be enough. I couldn't make, you know, $20 more. That's not really realistic based on the experience or my education. So I obtained a job that paid less so that I could have access to those resources, which ultimately did not make the situation completely better. I don't think that this is often talked about, but like SNAP dollars, you're not given a sufficient amount. It's not enough, and I won't go into the details about why I think that is, but it was never enough.
Campbell quotes research by an ISU graduate student showing 45% of college students nationally face some type of food insecurity. Campbell is now working towards a master's degree and, with help from Normal Township Supervisor Sarah Grammer, started the School Street Food Pantry that operates out of First United Methodist Church in Normal. She still struggles due to a lack of a livable wage combined with internship requirements and time spent on rigorous coursework. Many churches offer helping hands. Jana Vernon is part of the ministry at Abundant Life Church in the heart of downtown Bloomington that ministers to people living on the margins every day. A few years ago, while living in another city, Vernon was homeless herself for a while. She says poverty dramatically changes a person's life. She said being homeless makes people so vulnerable they're willing to sacrifice values and often make poor choices. Vernon says shame associated with poverty can be isolating as friends and a previous life slip away.
Your social group might come alongside you for a little while, but if you don't get your situation resolved, eventually that kind of wanes, and then you find yourself not as involved with that same social group, and you probably end up hanging out with people who maybe live more kind of like in the seedy side of society or the underbelly of society. People will come together who share those same struggles because they have an altruistic bond, and they can kind of relate and feel comfortable with each other because they don't have to confront the fact that they don't have the financial resources to do the things that others are doing. They can all kind of like share in their sort of like being down on their luck experience together. So it affects your life on a number of levels, and it can be even more difficult to come out of it because sometimes even with just getting jobs and stuff, you need resources even just to get a job, whether it's the transportation or you need to buy clothes to wear to work or help with resume building and stuff like that. Or if it's even just that you don't have a home address, there are certain things that you're going to have to miss out on just because you don't have a mailing address. Mm-hmm. So it becomes a pretty precarious situation. And if there isn't some kind of intervention that happens sooner than later, it does become something that has a pretty serious negative impact on public health.
I'm assuming you're talking about yourself, your experience?
That has been, some of it's been my experience personally, yes, but I've also seen that become the experience with some of the women I've ministered to and stuff like that. They have a long road ahead of them as far as regaining a sense of autonomy and self-efficacy and having the ability to just be confident that they can take care of themselves. It's definitely an uphill battle.
Vernon was asked about what contributes to poverty. She says trauma can have a crippling effect.
I think sometimes it can also be that if you have some kind of underlying mental illness, that can affect your ability to work and to function. And if you don't get treatment for that or the kind of help that you need, it can be a downward spiral and you can find yourself without support or a job. Or even if you're in a relationship that is abusive, there's a controlling element that prevents you from necessarily always being able to be kind of transparent about your life. You spend a lot of time hiding things when you're in situations like that because it's embarrassing. And so there's just a number of factors that can play into losing employment and ultimately being homeless or on the streets.
Meanwhile, Lisa Herzig says she suffered trauma at age 13 when her mother went to prison and Lisa went to foster care.
I ended up getting into one abusive relationship after another because at that point in my life, that was all I knew.
Herzig wound up at the YWCA's Labyrinth House.
I suffered from a lot of mental illness from it all, being traumatized through this all, and it affected my life a lot, and I stayed in certain situations because I had no choice. I had no other place to go. I would have been homeless without anything to eat, not knowing where to go at all. So it forced me to be stuck in a lot of situations that were not meant for me, and which ultimately led to my own incarceration. And which, you know, thank the Lord, it wasn't all that long, but it was long enough to, I lost my job. The job that I had was, you can't have a criminal record and still do this job. So I lost my job. I lost my home, which made me lose my car. Losing my car, I had no way to get to anything. It really put me down. I had nothing, nobody. And that's when I found the Labyrinth. I was actually in a domestic violence shelter after having my neck fractured. And I was in the shelter and I came to the Labyrinth, and that's when they approved me for the program, and I was then put on a waiting list. And like she said, I've been there since July, and programs like this are the best in the world. They really are. I mean, they help with so much that it's, I don't even know how to say thank you sometimes. I mean, I really don't. I would still probably be in that same abusive relationship. I would still probably be doing some of the things that I was doing. But because of programs like this, I was able to get out and I was able to make something of my life.
Kara Ault directs the Labyrinth program for women who've been in prison or jail and who need a variety of support, including transitional housing, job coaching, and transportation.
For anyone in the transitional living program, they do have to attend some groups to be in the program, and then outreach is invited as well. But we do things like communication skills, anger management, healthy relationships, and trauma recovery, and we host an NA meeting every week as well, and also self-care. So we kind of try to touch on all the topics there. And then we do case management. So I say we will do anything that they need help with, and if we can't, we will guide them to someone who can. So, you know, we try to do our best all around. And just with transitional living, they can live with us for up to 2 years.
Pat Turner also grew up in poverty. She says she wanted to be a part of the solution, even as others reached out to help her.
Thank goodness there were family church members that reached out and brought food to my house. Now, what they didn't know at the time was that God had given me a vision that I would run a food program. And when I saw them there at my door, I went, that's what I was supposed to be doing. And I actually took those bags of groceries that they shared. We kept one for our family, and we started the Center for Hope food pantry with the second one. I share that story because it's important that we understand that poverty must not be seen as just a problem to be solved. There are quality people who are facing poverty, who are challenged.
Turner says poverty often compounds simple problems such as a slight illness. Without sick days or money to cover unexpected child care, low-income people easily lose jobs. Turner says helping those suffering from the effects of poverty is important. Equally, if not more important, Turner says, is addressing systematic issues that cause poverty, including racism, sexism, and pay inequality. More affordable housing could also help. According to a McLean County Regional Planning Commission study, rent subsidies are available to fewer than 1,500 of the 8,000 households who need help. I'm Colleen Reynolds.
The League of Women Voters of McLean County will have another forum February 26th addressing how McLean County can overcome its shortage of affordable housing.
Support for GLT comes from CEFQ, offering competitive rates for home equity lines of credit. Borrowers get personalized service without the hidden fees or early payoff penalties. Plus, CEFQ even covers closing costs for qualified members. Information at CEFQ.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up next, a journey to Africa, finding your ancestors and yourself. An ethnomusicology professor from ISU speaks out in a TEDx Normal talk. Civil rights movements might be converging. For decades, LGBTQ, feminism, and African-American rights movements have had little overlap. Author and activist Charlene Carruthers carries the message to Illinois Wesleyan University today at the annual MLK teach-in. GLT's Mary Cullen has more.
Your keynote is titled Gender Justice is Social Justice, an Unapologetic Perspective on Black Liberation. Probably not coincidentally, you recently published a book with a similar title. It's called Unapologetic, A Black, Queer, and Feminist Mandate for Radical Movements. Now, the book outlines ways to make the Black liberation movement more radical, queer, and feminist. Can you discuss your passion for bringing innovation to the Black liberation movement?
For sure. Thank you. First, thank you so much for having me on. We're living in some astonishing times. And so for me, to be able to come back to my alma mater and discuss some of the most pressing issues of today, while celebrating the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., I believe is very timely, and I'm very honored to be able to do it. And so I believe that talking about these things in public, in open, having difficult conversations is essential to the work. And so how I understand even Dr. King's legacy is one that was a part of a broader movement to expand how people understood human rights, how people understood liberation. And towards the end of his life, he evolved substantially as a person and politically. And so to me, when I think about gender justice, social justice, and just overall collective liberation, the things are inextricably tied. If we're going to tell a story about what needs to be done, we need to tell as much of a complete story as possible.
Your book also discusses methods to make social justice movements more effective. What social justice movements do you think have succeeded in their effectiveness, and what would you like to see changed in others?
Well, I have to think about, I mean, there's so many places and times to draw inspiration from, and also places to draw deep reflection and lessons from. And I think what's most, like, current for people is this current movement era, right, and what's most relevant and present for folks. And what I believe has happened from the broader movement for Black Lives, movements for immigrant and migrant justice, and various movements for collective liberation here in the U.S. and abroad in the past even decade is that we've shifted the narrative of what it means to be free, what it means to be liberated, and saying that, no, we won't accept that some people get to be left out in the cold or some people get to be left off of the table for the sake of others. And that actually, if we're going to be serious about this business, our campaigns have to be reflective of the time, be it the campaign to grant secure clemency for Centoya Brown in Tennessee, the young Black woman who was charged and imprisoned after an act of self-defense from a person who purchased her against her will for acts that she didn't even want to perform, to shifting a narrative around policing in America and saying that we need to actually invest in our communities and divest from punitive practices that actually don't work for our people. And so I think that and then, of course, we can point to many electoral victories. I absolutely believe that the wave of young Black and brown women and indigenous women who have entered Congress absolutely have so much to do with the work that we've done in the past 5 to 6 years to build up momentum and popular consciousness around the need for a major shift in power.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mary Cullen speaking with Charlene Carruthers, a social justice activist and keynote speaker at Illinois Wesley University's Martin Luther King Jr. Teach-In. So Charlene, you're speaking at your alma mater during the university's annual MLK Teach-In. So what message are you trying to deliver to today's youth who are more and more recently becoming the foothold for these social justice movements that you speak of?
The biggest message for me is that there are a couple things. One,
is that we have to make a commitment to seeking out and telling the most complete stories we can possibly tell about the history of our people, the history of oppression, and the conditions that our people have lived in and continue to live within today. That's number one, because if we tell incomplete stories, we're going to have incomplete solutions. Number two is that we all have to actually do self-work on ourselves to interrogate and ask core questions. And I'll lay out the five questions that I talk about in Unapologetic during the talk, during the teaching. And then three is that we all like to agitate people around that they actually have a role in doing this work, and that there must be a choice. Like, we must actually make a choice to engage in the work. It doesn't happen overnight, and it's a lifelong journey, and it continues even after we're no longer here. And so those are three of the big touchstones that I intend to make during the teaching. I'm not a super scripted speaker. I'll write my remarks, but something can happen this weekend in the news cycle that will require me to shift a little bit of what I say, or something may happen on campus that will require me to shift it. So I expect there to be some new things as well.
How does your message change when you're speaking to, say, members of the Black community or feminists or members of the LGBTQ community?
Well, the truth is that Black people are members of all those communities, right? LGBTQ people are a part of all those communities. So for me, it's about being really clear that actually Black people are queer. Black people can be feminists. Black people can be all of the things. There's not one identity that I can think of in the world that Black people don't also have access to or have an experience or inherit. There may be some very limited experiences, but Black people's experiences in this world, they're so expansive, so I don't really change my message.
You have a quote on your website that reads, "Yes, I am Black. Yes, I am lesbian. Yes, I am a queer. Yes, I am woman. And yes, my eyes are squarely centered on Black liberation." So you're at an intersection of social justice themes yourself. How do you keep your passion for social justice alive in today's political climate?
Well, I'm very clear that I exist in a legacy and a lineage of people who've done this work before me, and that I'm not the first and I won't be the last to do it. And so I see it as a part of my responsibility and what I've inherited in the world to be involved in this work. I don't wake up every single morning wanting to do it, but I do wake up every single morning super excited about facing injustices or discussing or talking about injustices. I don't. And I understand that it's a part of a longer purpose, a deeper purpose beyond me as an individual, and that it actually impacts me as an individual and it matters to me as an individual.
So you're still young and you have many years to continue on this journey of Black liberation. What are your personal hopes for the future of the world?
Oh, my hopes for the world are that we first are able to deal with conflict, harm, and violence outside of systems of state-sanctioned punishment. And what that really means is that we deal with conflict, harm, and violence without prisons or policing. My imagination stretches to us being in right relationship with the land that we live on, one that's not extractive, one that doesn't destroy the earth. I want to live in a world where people are able to live within their full dignity, where people are indeed able to have fulfilled lives, to have communities that they see themselves a part of, and where accountability is not just a buzzword, but it's something that's just a part of how we love each other and what justice actually looks like.
And then what are your hopes for yourself?
Oh, my hopes for myself are that I live my life in the way that I say I want to live it. And I treat people in the way that I say I want to treat, and the way that people want to be treated. And I'm treated the way that I want to be treated, and that I'm able to live within my full dignity to be happy and have joy and love in my own life.
Activist and author Charlene Carruthers speaking with GLT's Mary Cullen ahead of an ML King Day teach-in at Illinois Wesleyan University on this Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Let's listen to the Black National Anthem.
Ring, ring with the joy, sing, rise. Let it resound loud as the rolling sea. Sing a song full of the faith that the dark past has taught us. Sing a song full of the hope that the present has brought.
Has brought us.
Oh, yeah. Facing the rising sun.
Let us march on
to victory is won.
The weekend's when you turn your brain off, but you can still play a little trivia, right?
Such low, oh God, this is gonna kill me. Low, small portions.
Yell your answers at your radio. Join me, Ophira Eisenberg, on NPR's Guiltiest and Most Puzzling Pleasure. Game on. Saturdays at 10 a.m. on GLT. Find a program schedule at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from Zimmerman & Armstrong Investment Advisors, offering securities through First Allied Securities, member FINRA SIPC. Over 30 years of experience, reputable financial management with an independent perspective. Drake Zimmerman has been a proud sponsor of GLT since 1983. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. It is a cruel irony that the first Christian church in what is now the country of Ghana is built in a coastal fort directly over the holding pens for the slave trade. Illinois State University ethnomusicology professor Ama Oforiwa Aduonum visited those caverns and speaks about them regularly. In this TEDx normal address, Oforiwa takes a walk with her ancestors. This mixture of speech, song, spiritual journey, and performance art is a journey from the dungeons in Ghana to America.
The dead know everything. They've been there from the beginning. They can intervene in our lives. So, I visited the spirits of the dead that reside in former slave dungeons at Cape Coast Castle in Ghana to learn from them. Cape Coast Castle is huge, heavy. This is where captured and shackled proud Africans were imprisoned for months until a ship came to transport those who survived across the Atlantic to plantations in America. I wanted to understand more deeply the magnitude of the crime that was committed by turning human beings into a commodity. Every Monday and Thursday in 2017, for 4 hours each time, over a period of 5 months, I sat in the dungeons. Each night before a visit, I did not eat, brush my teeth, bathe, or empty my bowels. I tossed and turned all night and could not sleep. In the morning, I traveled to Cape Coast Castle and changed into clothes that I had not washed in 5 months. Then I got shackled. Neck, legs, and wrists. I dragged myself into dark, damp holes underground. Sometimes I took fruit and water for our ancestors. I sat buried, scared, waiting 4 hours alone. I conversed with the spirits, asked questions. Who, what, when, why, how? I read them storybooks. I took in deep breaths to soak up the smell, pressed my back into the walls to connect. I wept. I sang. Bwe, 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 bwe. Wako, 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 wako. Enti abibi mampa. Na tuwa pansa mseye. Ah, abibi mai. Ena mitume niye nso obiao. Yempaye niye. Insu wafa yankura. Insu wafa yankura, abibi mai. Yewe ye niye. Shie. I missed my children. Numbed feet, frozen buttocks, tingly toes, stiff neck, wrists, hazy eyes, growling stomach, full bladder, dead vagina, shackles ate my skin. They suffered much, much longer. I massaged the cool, bumpy, damp floors, caressed the algae-covered walls. They were human beings and deserved to be loved. I fed them, ate with them. I danced, rocked, hugged, consoled them. There is a balm in Gilead to make the wounded whole. There is a balm in Gilead to heal you. I left the dungeons after each visit, disconnected, dazed and tongue-tied. My children asked, "Mama, what is wrong with you, Mama? Talk to us. Touch us, Mama." My body shut down after the first 2 weeks. Insomnia, gum disease, bronchitis, high blood pressure, constipation, urinary tract infection, menstrual disorder. I was losing my mind. Even the blacksmith did not make my shackles because the shackles haunt him. My family said I needed supervision and counseling. Towards the midpoint of my visits, my head was smashed into a windshield in a car accident. I wanted to quit. 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 But they were there continuously for months in shackles day and night. They did not have the choice to leave like I did. How did they survive the long walks through tunnels and woods? How did they survive the slave holes underground, the red hot branding iron? What had they become when they were dragged through the doors of no return into the holds of ships to a world of emptiness? Imagine. tight parking, weeks on the roaring sea, no fresh air, no light, darkness, menstrual blood flows, vomit, rampant diseases, rape, dehydration, starvation, diarrhea, the sick, the dead, thrown into sea, fed to sharks, decomposed dead bodies. No funerary rites, no goodbyes. Trauma, gaps. I benefit from their suffering, sacrifices, and death. We all benefit. So no, I couldn't quit. I kept dragging the shackles to the last day of my scheduled visit. For nobody knows the trouble they've seen. Nobody knows their sorrows. Nobody knows their trauma. How did some survive? What had they become when they were dumped onto plantations in the Americas? What scars did they have on their bodies, minds, souls, DNAs? Lately, I've been wondering, who are the descendants of those enslaved Africans? Where are they? Are they here? What scars did they inherit? Are they also shackled? Our own people? I think about my life in America. Black, female, professor with a PhD. The stories by other faculty and staff of color, undervalued, unfair assessments, invisible, pigeonholed, alone, chased out. I think about my daughter, my son, and the daily aggressions they face. Is the dungeon in me? Or am I in the dungeon? Because sometimes I feel like a motherless child, a long way from home, a long way from home. Do the shackles come off? How are we going to deal with the ghosts of slavery that continue to shackle all of us? When are we going to start treating all humans equally, with dignity, kindness, mercy, and love? The dead know everything. It is up to us, all of us, to discover the lessons they have left for us. Tama, tama, tamale. Zenzere.
Ama Oforiwa Adwonum is a professor of ethnomusicology at Illinois State University. She gave her speech, Walking with My Ancestors, A Journey from Dungeons in Ghana to America, at a TEDx conference in Normal. GLT airs the TED Radio Hour with similar speeches and stories at 6 and 10 a.m. Sundays on Bloomington Normal's public media.
Tree falls, winter calls. They wait on the sideline. Time one promise led the whole world's inconsolable. Yeah, Maria.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Illinois has a new governor, and the Illinois Politics Roundtable looks at what's ahead in challenges and priorities for J.B. Pritzker. Sean Crawford moderates the panel, composed of Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield, IPR Statehouse editor Brian Mackey, and IPR reporters Daisy Contreras and Jacqueline Driscoll. Driscoll watched Democrats rejoice at the Bank of Springfield Center.
It was a very exciting atmosphere. Daisy and I actually were kind of milling about the room and talking to both Democrats and Republicans, and both seemed like they were excited. Obviously, Democrats, because they do have the supermajority. They have J.B. Pritzker coming in as their governor, Democratic governor, so going to see some progressive ideas moving forward. But also even Republicans seemed a little, you know, okay, we're going to put these past 4 years behind us. We're going to move forward, and it's going to be a good day for Illinois.
And as Jacqueline was saying, as we heard, it was an extravagant inauguration ceremony that felt more like a concert. Mm-hmm. The music numbers kept people in the audience, both Democrats and Republicans, dancing in their seats. And that was followed by a very fancy reception at the Illinois State Fairgrounds, where the music performance was given by Maroon 5, which I must mention, who will also be performing at the Super Bowl in just 2 weeks. There were rumors floating around Paul McCartney would perform, but as we saw, that wasn't the case.
I'll still say George Ryan with Ray Charles may have topped them all, but that was still a big deal. It was a lot of interest that day. And Charlie, that's not uncommon for, I guess, for an inauguration. I mean, I think Bruce Rauner, there was a lot of excitement among people who'd supported him when he was sworn in. That tends to be the case in most of these.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing where it's the dawn of a new day. You have a new administration coming in, and everybody's hopes are up, and there's talk about working together with people from the other party to move Illinois forward. We'll see how well that works out. In the case of Governor Rauner, it didn't work out very well at all, as Governor Pritzker alluded to in his inaugural address. I get the sense from hearing what Republicans are saying that they're kind of glad that the Rauner administration is now past tense also, and they're looking forward to being able to work with Pritzker. There's issues on which they're going to disagree for sure. Like Senate Minority Leader Bill Brady said the other day that on the graduated income tax, that's an area where they're just going to have to disagree. But there'll be other areas, he said, where they can work together. And I think that's kind of the atmosphere or the attitude that you want to see going forward, where people with differing philosophies can agree to disagree on some things, but can also work to find common ground on other issues where they can advance the state.
We also saw, though, I mean, just minutes after Governor J.B. Pritzker finished up his speech, there was a statement sent out by GOP Chairman Tim Schneider saying basically we're going to hold Madigan, J.B. Pritzker, and all the Democrats accountable because, you know, they're the reason for Illinois' demise. So even though we're having Bill Brady and House Minority Leader Jim Durkin taking a more mild approach seems to be a little bit more supportive, there is still that Republican voice out there that is very much against the progressive agenda.
Well, Brian. Yeah, but I would look at Tim Schneider as being very much past tense. He's a guy who was handpicked, put in his position by Rauner, supported by Rauner's money. He lost, if I'm not mistaken, his race for the county board in Cook County. And so he's there on the sidelines. I would ignore whatever he has to say, and I would pay a lot more attention to what the legislative leaders have to say, because they're in the ball game, and he's somewhere out in the bleachers.
Well, and Schneider, that's kind of his role here. Mm-hmm. He's partisan in this matter, and he's trying to, you know, pump the Republicans up. Now, Brian, speaking of that, it was not what I'd call the most bipartisan speech that I heard given by J.B. Pritzker. He seemed to make some not-so-veiled references to Bruce Rauner in that speech, and Bruce Rauner sitting right there watching this all taking place.
Yeah, he sure did. Pritzker says, "I won't hollow out the functions of government to achieve an ideological agenda. I won't make government the enemy and government employees the scapegoats."
That's Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois Springfield and Daisy Contreras and Jacqueline Driscoll of IPR, moderated by Sean Crawford. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A new exhibit in the Twin Cities allows a comprehensive look into the lives of Native Americans and explores the connections between wellness and cultural life. GLT Arts correspondent Laura Kennedy has more.
The great Native tradition of oral history highlights a unique exhibition that's currently up through February 14th in Ames Library on the Illinois Wesleyan University campus in Bloomington. Native Voices, Native People's Concepts of Health and Illness examines health and medicine among contemporary American Indians, Alaska Natives, and Native Hawaiians. Meg Miner is the university archivist and special collections librarian, and she says this exhibit uses a combination of interviews, artwork, and interactive media. Karen Schmidt is the university librarian, and she says this exhibition is cross-disciplinary.
And we have a lot of students here who are either pre-med or some are schooled nursing, and so the connection for them in particular seemed really strong to us. This is a joint exhibit from American Library Association and National Library of Medicine, pulling together, you know, the voice of our Native Americans.
There's art, there's talk about cultural heritage, in addition to healing practices and wellness, attitudes towards wellness.
And it's high tech because we have iPads here with headphones so that people can listen.
The powwow is an ancient Native American tradition that still serves to gather the community. Elders lead the grand entry, followed by military veterans, and then by other honored members and organizations. The gathering of the community is a cherished practice because in a traditional society, the community is a source of support and healing.
The bulk of the exhibit are people telling their stories. So it really is the voices of these people in these communities. And what the National Library of Medicine did was curate it so that it's around six different themes, which we have banners that go along with all of the iPad stands on different themes. So there's the individual, there's community, there's nature, healing, and the
tradition.
Of an overview of different traditions, right? So the iPads themselves all have the same app on them. They can be launched into any number of different ways, looking at the art or a timeline of Native people and their interactions with other communities.
Were you able to consult with any local Native American people to ask about their input?
Absolutely, and we have two of the Lakota sisters, Lita and Carol, who are local in this region, who've been incredibly helpful to us. Our opening ceremony on Friday night was a Spirit of the Rainbow Singers, which certainly are Native Americans from this area. So we mined and connected with our population here.
And we were fortunate, too, that Rebecca Gerhardt, is on our anthropology department here, has established relationships with some of these communities, too. So these are groups that come to our campus frequently. And when we first started planning this, we had Dr. Gerhardt in the planning session. We also had Dr. Noelle Kerr, who is in our nursing department.
Can you tell me about the associated events you have going on all through this exhibition, Meg?
Sure. So we started with our opening ceremony on Friday, and that was the Spirit of the Rainbow Singers. Phenomenal event, and really helped us, I think, ground our understanding of song in these practices and the role of song in healing. And it was very educational, I thought, too. And then next Thursday at 7 p.m. or 6 p.m. here in the library, we'll have the medicine wheel teaching.
What is a medicine wheel?
Which is what the Lakota sisters help us with. So it's a way that I'm actually going to be learning about it myself.
Okay.
But I understand that they'll have different stations set up and people will be able to put together different artifacts from the tables that are going to be part of the medicine wheel. I've never actually taken part in one myself.
It's part of the four directions. They pull the four directions together into a healing bundle.
So, and then the final event that we have scheduled is an Illinois Wesleyan alumna who took on a research project based on a book that she read in our old Buck Library on campus when she was a student here. She's a member of the class of 1960.
So that's before the Ames Library was built.
The Ames Library. The she found a book about Native Americans who served in the Civil War and was fascinated by this. And she had a completely different career. She was a chemist and never lost her interest in this topic and actually lived in a place in Michigan where this group had come from. And so started doing research on her own and published a book in 2017 about a sharpshooting unit in the Civil War. And she's published biographies on all of these people. So I think it was like 140 people in this unit. And part of what she found out in her research was how the healing practices of the U.S. Army were quite a bit different from what they received in their native communities. And so she's going to be able to tell us some stories about the kinds of treatments that they received while they were in the war, and then also the effects of being away from home and community.
So does this exhibition address perhaps traditional Western medicine and how it has impacted Native peoples and how their medicine developed?
This is really, I think, helping us understand how Native American healing practices are grounded in certainly the whole person, the spirituality, the connection with nature.
For Native peoples, healing is more than the treatment of physical symptoms. It is intertwined with larger concepts of health that are derived from balance in nature, community support, positive tribal identity, and individual self-respect. Traditional healers spend large amounts of time with their patients, working to discover the root causes of their illness. This process often involves a spiritual journey.
Of course, the people who are participating in these groups today are of our society as well, right? So there is some discussion in some of the videos about the interaction of modern culture and traditional ways and how you find identity and bring your practices into those types of situations as well. So I think it's a good blending of very much being centered on the Native people's voices, which is what it's called, and then how those people interact with the Western society that we have around them.
Does the exhibition address how there was inhibition of culture for Native people and how that would affect their wellness?
There is a segment on boarding schools, certainly, that I've seen. There is something on the Native American code talkers who served in World War II. I think that would probably be woven through all of it. Yeah, I think the interconnectedness of the colonial cultures on Native peoples is certainly part of this.
And certainly loss of land as well, because with loss of land, there would be loss of identity.
In our opening ceremony, our chaplain, Elise Nelson-Winger, very poignantly pointed out that even the land on which this particular building is built in this campus once belonged to Native Americans. And we need to recall that and to honor that and to give that space.
What have you learned from this exhibition so far that has really surprised you?
I would say that I'm very touched with the people who've been coming in to listen, who are not Native American, but who seem to be called to listen to a different perspective. And it's been very gratifying to watch community members come in. And we're hoping, we've invited all of the school districts to come in. There are curriculum plans that go along with this. We're hoping to see some children in here, too, who will come to understand this whole heritage and how it's woven into our prairie.
That's Karen Schmidt and Meg Miner from Ames Library at Illinois Wesleyan University. Native Voices, Native People's Concepts of Health and Illness runs through February 14th. I'm Laura Kennedy.
You can see photos of the exhibit at our website, WGLT.org. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. And that's where you can find Sound Ideas, interviews, and stories with help today from Colleen Reynolds and Mary Cullen. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.